Before I start, I'd like to announce a concert a week from Friday night, Susan Greats, May 14th at 8 p.m., Kaufman Auditorium, Goldwyn Smith. It's co-sponsored by Women's Studies, GAYPAC, Ithaca Women's Resource Center, and Hordes of Women. Adrienne Rich is the first A.D. White Professor at Large to be sponsored by Women's Studies, and this afternoon's poetry reading is the first chance for the Women's Studies program and the larger Ithaca feminist community to welcome her publicly as one of us. As most of you know, she's among the most distinguished poets writing in English today and a leading feminist thinker. Her long list of honors begins with the Yale Series of Younger Poets Award in 1951 and includes many other poetry awards, Guggenheim Fellowships, and the National Book Award, a prize she declined on her own behalf, but accepted in 1974 together with Audre Lorde and Alice Walker in the name of all the women whose voices have gone and still go unheard in a patriarchal world. Adrienne Rich herself has published 12 volumes of poetry and 2 of prose. Her poems are widely anthologized and translated, and she's given readings and lectured many places. With Michelle Cliff, she now edits the lesbian feminist journal Sinister Wisdom, and she was the recipient in 1981 of the National Gay Task Force Human Dignity Award. I could go on and on, of course, going through the vita, but I won't. I'll just tell you a little bit about how it was we got Adrienne Rich to come here. It was about 3 years ago that we in Women's Studies began to try to arrange a visit. Springtime is nice, we said, and we suggested a number of activities such a visit might include. Discussing Of Woman Born, her brilliant analysis of motherhood as experience and as institution. Grappling with her vision of a woman-centered university. Exploring together the politics of language and the need to develop a common language. Accepting her challenge in the essay, Disloyal to Civilization, Feminism, Racism, and Gynophobia, to work at breaking out of the tunnels that impair our vision of one another. And of course, we also said, we want to hear you read your poetry. We talked about dates, and back in the summer of 79, selected a week in April 1981, not thinking then that further visits would prove possible. All of us here today owe thanks to Sandra Siegel of Women's Studies in English, who coordinated Women's Studies' nomination of Adrienne Rich as an A.D. White Professor at Large, and was able to announce its success at that long-awaited reading last spring. To our great delight, Adrienne has accepted the A.D. White Professorship, and we are able to come together again this spring to share her poetry. This is, it seems to me, especially appropriate, for it is through that poetry that we know her best, know the many women she has been and is becoming. And for many of us, it is also in part through that poetry that we have come to know our own and other selves in new ways. For women, says Audre Lorde, poetry is not a luxury. It is a vital necessity of our existence. Poetry is not only dream or vision, it is the skeleton architecture of our lives. As we try to build new forms of life, we thank you, Adrienne, for coming here to work with us and welcome you again to Ithaca.
Studies program, and thank you all for this welcome. I'm very happy to be back, and I look forward to still more visits Coming back here just one year after my last visit, I realized that there's a tremendous benefit, certainly for me, in coming back to ground that has already become a little bit familiar. It seems to make so much more possible in all kinds of ways. I want to start by reading two poems which are not my own, but which are important to me and which I would like to claim as voices of sisters. There are two poems from the just published anthology, Nice Jewish Girls, a lesbian anthology, published by Persephone Press, which, as many of you know, also published This Bridge Called My Back, Writings by Radical Women of Color, and Lesbian Poetry and Lesbian Fiction, two very important and groundbreaking anthologies. The first poem is a section of a longer poem by Irina Klepfisch called Bashert. And the word Bashert in Hebrew means inevitable, predestined. I'm very proud to say that we will be publishing the entire text of Bashert in Sinister Wisdom in the fall. This is the introductory section of the poem. And in these lines, I believe that Irina Klepfisch is talking, first of all, out of her experience as a child who survived the Warsaw Ghetto with her mother and who survived the Holocaust, who emigrated to this country, thinking of specifically the Holocaust, but also of the whole long history of the Jewish people under anti-Semitism. And beyond that, I believe, in the best Jewish tradition of all people everywhere who have or have not survived persecution and oppression. These words are dedicated to those who died. These words are dedicated to those who died because they had no love and felt alone in the world, because they were afraid to be alone and tried to stick it out, because they could not ask, because they were shunned, because they were sick and their bodies could not resist the disease, because they played it safe, because they had no connections, because they had no faith, because they felt they did not belong and wanted to die. These words are dedicated to those who died because they were loners and liked it, because they acquired friends and drew others to them, because they took risks, because they were stubborn and refused to give up, because they asked for too much. These words are dedicated to those who died because a card was lost and a number skipped, because a bed was denied, because a place was filled and no other place was left. These words are dedicated to those who died because someone did not follow through, because someone was overworked and forgot, because someone left everything to God, because someone was late, because someone did not arrive at all, because someone told them to wait and they just couldn't any longer. These words are dedicated to those who died because death is a punishment, because death is a reward, because death is the final rest, because death is eternal rage. These words are dedicated to those who died, Bashert. These words are dedicated to those who survived. These words are dedicated to those who survived because their second grade teacher gave them books, because they did not draw attention to themselves and got lost in the shuffle, because they knew someone who knew someone else who could help them and bumped into them on a corner on a Thursday afternoon, because they played it safe, because they were lucky. These words are dedicated to those who survived because they knew how to cut corners, because they drew attention to themselves and always got picked, because they took risks, because they had no principles and were hard. These words are dedicated to those who survived because they refused to give up and defied statistics, because they had faith and trusted in God, because they expected the worst and were always prepared, because they were angry, because they could ask, because they mooched off others and saved their strength, because they endured humiliation, because they turned the other cheek, because they looked the other way. These words are dedicated to those who survived, because life is a wilderness and they were savage, because life is an awakening and they were alert, because life is a flowering and they blossomed, because life is a struggle and they struggled, because life is a gift and they were free to accept it. These words are dedicated to those who survived. Bashert. And this poem by Melanie Kay, who is a feminist, lesbian feminist activist and theorist and critic and poet. This is called Notes of an Immigrant Daughter, Atlanta. You dream of what it looked like before the Europeans came, before they brought the Africans chained, when native peoples rode, hunted, grew corn, and sang all over the many nations' face, Cheyenne, Sioux, Cherokee, Pontiac, Comanche, Winnebago, Passamaquoddy, Navajo, Mohican, Apache, Kiowa, Hopi, Chickasaw, too many to name. One, a movie, Birth of a Nation, called a classic. Black women have rolling eye whites. White women are blonde and rapable by black men. The Ku Klux Klan is the hero. When they show this movie in Greensboro, North Carolina, people, black and white, gather to protest. Five are shot dead by local Nazis and the hero Klan. The one time I was in Atlanta, some rich white women told us, don't go downtown at night. So we go downtown. It's alive with black people, women, men, out on the streets after the movies or concert. Something to fear? Down here, death's face is white. The one time I camped in Alabama, I kept thinking, we're Northerners, dykes and commies. You a Catholic, me a Jew. If we had no dog, if we had no gun, how could we sleep? Klansmen on trial right now in Greensboro claiming self-defense. Two, in France they're bombing synagogues. This country, concerned as usual when Jews get killed, says nothing. And the summer we lived in Maine, on the bedroom door someone had painted in blood swastikas. We painted over their sick breath. Still, the house stunk. I can't go back where I came from, was burned off the map. I'm a Jew. Anywhere is someone else's land. Three. I dream I'm climbing a ladder behind a young woman, blonde, dressed punk style, stitched on the leg of her jeans in green and pink letters, the words, "How will you die? Who will you kill?" In the morning, I read the news. In Atlanta, black children are being killed. A daycare center blows up. Children go out to play or to the store and disappear. 15 missing or found strangled, shot or drowned or dead, cause undetermined. For months, they say these deaths are not related. 4. All over the nation is someone else's land. For example, the whole state of Maine might have been Passamaquoddy Nation had the treaty saved by a woman in a shoebox been honored as written, had the people risked everything on the young one's faith. They won millions of acres anyhow, and dollars, and the children can all go to college, but first they learn their language and their people's ways. 5. A mother's voice booming across the TV miles. "How many children going to lose their lives, Mr. Mayor, before you do something?" The papers say the mothers just don't take care. Mother of a murdered child keening, "They didn't tell us about the danger. If I'd known, I'd never have let him out. My baby be alive." Some people charge the mothers have done the killing. Mother of children not yet dead shouts, "Mr. Mayor, we don't want to see you on TV. We don't want to see you next week. We want to see you now about our children." Mother of a murdered child and 3 still living, Camille Bell, says, "If they were white children," but interrupts the white reporter, "The mayor, the chief of the police are black." He means, "Aren't you satisfied?" Camille Bell looks past him, says, "These children were black and poor." While newspapers I clip and save in a shoebox say, "The Klan practices guerrilla warfare outside of Atlanta, outside of Nashville, as outside Houston and Dallas, as outside Buffalo and Kingston, as outside Portland, Oregon, as outside Youngstown, Ohio, the Klan gathers. How will we die? Who will we kill?" Klansmen on trial in Greensboro, verdict, not guilty. If they were white children, if the mayor were on welfare, if the governor got pregnant, if the president had suckled babies instead of sucking off the Trilateral Commission, would death's face be leering all over the world? As in Atlanta, where mothers, as always, teach children how to survive. "Don't get in anyone's car, children, is that correct?" And to sing with the preacher in church, "Jesus loves the little children, all God's children in the world. Red and yellow, black and white, they are precious. And in the sight of their mothers, they are precious. Mr. Mayor, Mr. President, Mr. President, Mr. Chairman of the Board." One of the Klansmen acquitted in Greensboro has already been shot at. In Atlanta, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 23, 25, 28 children are dead or missing. And we want to see you now about our children. 6. Don't say it's over. They caught the killer, one black man. The white South stands on corners with Bibles shaking hands. Why whistle Dixie unless you like the tune? Why call a restaurant Plantation House unless you mourn the demise? Why move the people from their land unless you want it? At a house named for plantations, I cannot eat. Nor can I go back. My people were burned off the map. The flames still crackle on crosses in Buffalo, Portland, Atlanta, all over the nation. Our children are watching to see who we become. I'm going to read my own work now. This is a poem from Dream of a Common Language, and it's called Origins and History of Consciousness, which is the title of a book by Erich Neumann, but I just borrowed the title and left the book. Nightlife, letters, journals, bourbon sloshed in the glass, poems crucified on the wall, dissected, their bird wings severed like trophies. No one lives in this world. No, I'm sorry, I'm going to start again because that noise sort of bothered me. Nightlife, letters, journals, bourbon sloshed in the glass, poems crucified on the wall, dissected, their bird wings severed like trophies. No one lives in this room without living through some kind of crisis. No one lives in this room without confronting the whiteness of the wall behind the poems, planks of books, photographs of dead heroines, without contemplating last and late the true nature of poetry, the drive to connect, the dream of a common language. Thinking of lovers, their blind faith, their experienced crucifixions, my envy is not simple. I have dreamed of going to bed as walking into clear water ringed by a snowy wood, white as coal sheets, thinking I'll freeze in there. My bare feet are numbed already by the snow, but the water is mild. I sink and float like a warm amphibious animal that has broken the net, has run through fields of snow, leaving no print. This water washes off the scent. You are clear now of the hunter, the trapper, the wardens of the mind. Yet the warm animal dreams on of another animal swimming under the snow-flecked surface of the pool and wakes and sleeps again. No one sleeps in this room without the dream of a common language. It was simple to meet you, simple to take your eyes into mine, saying, these are eyes I have known from the first. It was simple to touch you against the hacked background, the grain of what we had been, the choices, years. It was even simple to take each other's lives in our hands as bodies. What is not simple, to wake from drowning, from where the ocean beat inside us like an afterbirth, into this common, acute particularity, these two selves who walked half a lifetime untouching, to wake to something deceptively simple, a glass sweated with dew, a ring of the telephone, a scream of someone beaten up far down in the street, causing each of us to listen to her own inward scream, knowing the mind of the mugger and the mugged, as any woman must who stands to survive this city, this century, this life. Each of us having loved the flesh in its clenched or loosened beauty, better than trees or music, yet loving those two as if they were flesh, and they are, but the flesh of beings unfathomed as yet in our roughly literal life. It's simple to wake from sleep with a stranger, dress, go out, drink coffee, enter a life again. It isn't simple to wake from sleep into the neighborhood of one neither strange nor familiar, whom we have chosen to trust. Trusting, untrusting, we lowered ourselves into this, let ourselves downward, hand over hand, as on a rope that quivered over the unsearched. We did this, conceived of each other, conceived each other in a darkness which I remember as drenched in light. I want to call this life, but I can't call it life until we start to move beyond this secret circle of fire where our bodies are giant shadows flung on a wall, where the night becomes our inner darkness and sleeps like a dumb beast, head on her paws in the corner. Last year, I think I read to you a number of poems from A Wild Patience Has Taken Me This Far, because the book was very much in process, and I was just beginning to read from it. I don't know whether I said then, because I don't know whether I recognized then, how much this is a book about history and the uses of history, memory and the uses of memory. And I feel as if it had a subtitle, that subtitle might be Against Amnesia. We live in a culture which is almost obliterating itself on amnesia. Events are forgotten so fast. We have such a short memory of our own history that, and there is such a pressure to both be thinking either in terms of no future at all or future shock or some accelerated kind of contemporariness, or to look back to an era such as the 1950s with, quote, nostalgia. Well, for some of us who lived through the 1950s, nostalgia is hardly the name of the game. And I think that the very concept of nostalgia is an incredibly dangerous concept, whether it's nostalgia for a particular time in our own lives or for a particular historical era that we may remember dimly or not at all. I think that nostalgia does what Ellen Glasgow once said sentimentality did. She said sentimentality, she had revolted against sentimentality because it is cruel, because it makes people blind to what happens. Well, I think that in that sense, nostalgia can also be very cruel. The poem I'm going to read now is called For Ethel Rosenberg. And when I read this poem, I sometimes wonder whether nostalgia has so overtaken us that everyone knows or remembers who Julius and Ethel Rosenberg were. They were a married couple who became scapegoats of the McCarthy period. They were accused of selling atomic bomb secrets to the Soviet Union. And during their trial, all kinds of pressures were brought on Ethel in particular to confess, including allegations that if she weren't such a bad mother, she would confess because she had young children at home, and that instead she was willing to stay in jail and even to risk death. The death penalty had never before been demanded in a case of espionage. And the Rosenbergs were very clearly being made an example of, one of those examples, which is used to terrorize a great many other people into silence and into passivity and inactivity. That they were Jews, I think, is no coincidence, since anti-Semitism could be used and brought into the forces against them, along with sort of generalized popular anti-communist feelings. I think of the execution of the Rosenbergs as my own first jolt into some kind of political consciousness, although what it meant to me, as this poem shows, took a long time for me to understand. And in